That's much more than you all needed to know about me. okay, so thanks very much for having me. I always enjoy listening to KSP. So there are sort of two threads to this story. And the first is the notion that singularities, CFT correlators, are interesting. Now, singularities in Euclidean signature are relatively well understood. The only singularities in Euclidean correlators are essentially OP singularities, where you have two points, x1 and x2, and they're becoming coincident. And the behavior of the correlator in this limit is well described by the operator product expansion. But in Lorentzian signature, there's a much richer and less well understood story. So a simple example of a Lorentzian singularity is sort of the cousin of the Euclidean OP singularity, which is a light cone singularity, where we have two points, x1 and x2, and x2 is approaching the light cone of x1. So that's relatively simple. But more generally, we don't know precisely what the singularities can be in Lorentzian signature. On the other hand, in perturbation theory, there is an answer to this. In perturbation theory, singularities can occur if you can draw a Landau diagram. Where the rules for a Landau diagram are that you take the external operators and you draw null on-shell lines coming from each operator, and maybe they intersect at interaction points and then connect up. And it should be possible to assign a momentum, an energy momentum, to each null line such that energy and momentum are conserved at interaction points. So if such a configuration exists, if it's possible to draw such a graph, then one can show that at least a particular Feynman diagram in perturbation theory could give you a singularity. Yes? Oh, sure.
Yeah, did anyone here just ask for a microphone?
Yeah.
Perfect. So just a one microphone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unless anyone else wants a microphone.
Sorry.
Okay,
Thank
you.
That's fine. Should I keep going?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, so it could be possible that there could be cancellations between different Feynman diagrams, but this is at least a necessary condition to have a singularity in perturbation theory. So this story gets more interesting if instead of thinking about usual perturbation theory for some CFT with Lagrangian, we think about large N perturbation theory, in a theory with a weakly coupled ADS dual. If we're doing large N perturbation theory in a theory with a weakly coupled ADS dual, then instead of drawing Landau diagrams on the boundary, we should draw them in the bulk. And if we start drawing Landau diagrams in the bulk, then it can happen that there are diagrams that would suggest, naively, a singularity in the CFT correlator that doesn't correspond to any boundary Landau diagram. So an example of this, the one that I'll focus on in this talk, is where we take two operators. So we live on the Lorentzian cylinder. And actually, I'll specialize for most of the talk. Well, yeah, most of the talk will be about the case d equals 2, but also make comments about higher dimensions. So So for now, let's just imagine the Lorentzian cylinder for a two-dimensional CFT with ADS3 on the inside. And we're going to take two operators and put them in time zero. So this is at t equals zero. And then two other operators at time close to pi. So pi plus some delta t that we'll play with. But also diametrically opposite from each other, but with some angle. Yeah,
thank you.
I'm seeing
this wrong.
Okay. So can you check? If it's not, give me a holder. It's on. Oh, it is on. Hello?
Okay, I will
bring you a holder. Okay, thanks. Have you ever given a talk without a holder? Alright. Good, so if we have the operators in this configuration, then it's possible to draw a lambda diagram, where we take these two operators in the boundary, they source light-like particles that propagate in, interact at the center of ADS, and then they scatter at fixed angles, come out at some other angle to these points in the boundary. So this suggests that in large end perturbation theory, there should be a singularity as delta t goes to zero. I mentioned this in words, but let me just make it very clear that this singularity doesn't correspond to anything you could ever get in boundary perturbation theory. To see that, let's try to draw a lambda diagram of the boundary. So the boundary is a cylinder, so let's unfold it. So this distance is 2 pi, and the time direction of the distance is pi. And we have two operators on diametric sides of the circle. So here's O1, O2, and then the other two, so this part is identified with that one, so I can also draw an operator there. That's just O1 again. And then we have our other operators at some other angles. We can argue very simply that it's not possible to draw a lambda diagram. So let's imagine starting at time zero and drawing a lambda diagram, propagating forward in time. The only thing that can happen is that we can have light-like particles coming out of these guys like this, and nothing interesting can occur until they intersect at time pi over 2. So the bottom of the diagram has to look like this, but we could also start it in the future and run time backwards, and we would find that the top of the diagram has to look like this, and of course there's no way to connect up the bottom and the top, so there's simply no lambda diagram. This is not a contradiction, because we don't expect the bulk and the boundary to be perturbative at the same time. But it does emphasize that this is an interesting locus at which to look at the CFT correlator. And it raises a few questions, which will be the motivating questions for this talk. So the first one is, what does the correlator actually look like? At this locus. What is the connection to bulk locality? And also, what can we say non-perturbatively about CFT singularities in general? So using bulk arguments, I'll start by trying to figure out what we expect the CFT correlator to look like, we'll develop a story there, and then I'll try to figure out how much of that story can be recovered from the CFT. Unfortunately, at this point, not a huge amount of it can be recovered from the CFT, and I'll try to emphasize some of the mysteries about n equals 4 super Yang Mills that are clarified in thinking about the setup, but remain mysteries. And what I'll mostly have to say about is an answer to this question, the structure of singularities non-perturbatively in two-dimensional CFTs. So that's what I'll end the talk with. Are there any questions before I keep going? Okay. Good, so let's start from the point of view of the bulk and ask what the corollary looks like. And we'll start by reproducing in more detail this singularity in perturbation theory as delta t goes to zero. And I should say these singularities were first noticed by Steve Giddings and Joao Panadonis and
Michael Geary.
Yep. Thank you. So let's give a simple calculation that that recovers their observation. So for this calculation, we'll think of ADS as a hyperboloid in d plus two dimensions of the following form. So we're living in the embedding space R two comma d. We're going to be interested in physics near the center of ADS, which we can take to be the vector 1, comma 0, where this lives in R1, comma d. And actually, we'll be interested in physics near the center, so I'll introduce Q, which are locally flat space coordinates near the center of ADS. So these also live in X lives in 1, comma d, and parameterizes flat space region near the center of ADS. Yes. And we're interested in a correlator with boundary points that are almost null separated from the center. So a boundary point is represented by a null vector in d equals two dimensions. And the reason is because what we have here is some hyperboloid inside the d equals two dimensional light cone. So this is ADS. And to specify a point on the boundary, we can just specify a direction on the light cone. That's equivalent to specifying a boundary point. So we want a null vector in d equals two dimensions. And we also want it to be nearly null separated from the center. So that means that it should have the following form. So 0 comma n means that it has zero dot product with the center vector, which is implies that it's null separated from it. And this here should be null. So little n is a null d plus one dimensional vector, and it basically represents the direction of these null lines coming from the boundary in local coordinates near the center of ADS. And we want to take our operators to be almost null separated from the center. So let's add in a small parameter here, sigma, which we'll take to be very small. And sigma is related to delta t in a simple way. And we eventually want to take it to zero and see what happens. Okay. So let's write the bulk to boundary wave function. So this is minus 2 q dot x to the minus delta. This is essentially the only thing you can write down consistent with conformal invariance. The conformal group is the Lorentz group in this space, so we can only use dot products. X is null, so x squared is 0. Q squares to minus 1 because it's a point in ADS, so this is the only non-trivial invariant we have. And so we can write this by introducing a Schwinger parameter, omega, as some exponential. And this exponential, when we plug in these coordinates, you can see that it's basically a plane wave. It's a plane wave with momentum omega times n. So this operator on the boundary is sourcing particles with momentum in the direction of n, but with arbitrarily high energies. And the weighting of low versus high energies is determined by the dimension of the operator. So we have an integral over all energies of a bunch of plane waves. And so the four-point function in this limit is essentially the amplitude, the flat space scattering amplitude for these plane waves integrated over energy, over an energy scale. So the four-point function is an integral of the overall energy of the process, some weighting that depends on the operator dimensions, times the flat space amplitude evaluated at momentum equal to omega times n. And then there's this additional factor that comes from the deviation of the points in the boundary from being null separated from the center. And if you put everything together, this just becomes I omega delta t. So in the example of, let's say, a contact interaction in ADS, for example, of the following form, the amplitude is some polynomial of momenta, and so the integral just gives us some powers of omega coming from the amplitude to this factor, and then it's only cut off by this extra piece. And so there's a singularity as delta t goes to 0, which looks like 1 over delta t to the 4 delta plus 2k minus 3. And I should say we're also doing 1 over n perturbation theory, so there's going to be a 1 over n squared up front. Okay, so here you can see very explicitly that the claim that there's a singularity really comes from using local field theory in the bulk. And the computation that we did here is really sensitive to the UV behavior of the bulk theory. Of course, this this amplitude here that we used, this some polynomial amplitude coming from a contact interaction, is probably not the right UV behavior of the bulk theory. So let's think about the validity of this calculation and what we actually expect the answer to look like. Okay, so singularity is coming from high energy fixed angle scattering. In ADS. So let's think about a couple examples of different types of bulk theory. One example is in string theory. So in string theory, of course, as we know very well from David, the behavior of an amplitude in the high energy fixed angle regime is very different from what it is in local field theory. In particular, there's a suppression. So we expect suppression that looks like e to the minus alpha prime omega squared, where here I mean alpha prime in units of the ADS radius. And I'll set the ADS radius to 1 for all of this talk. So we have a suppression of this form. If we then take this and plug it into the integral, it cuts off, no matter what the value of delta t is, it cuts off the integral when omega gets of order the string scale. So this kills the singularity. When delta t is of order all string. There's an interesting question here about what the very, very high energy behavior actually should be. The reason is because this suppression here, this omega squared, is really the area of the world sheet that dominates in a saddle point computation at this high energy. And so the reason for the suppression is that the world sheet is growing at high energies, and its action is suppressing the answer. But of course, if the world sheet grows too big, then it can start to become sensitive to the geometry of ADS, not just the geometry of some flat space region. So there's going to be some modification in this answer coming from the world sheet probing the actual geometry of ADS. But of course, that happens already after this exponential suppression has kicked in. So this will determine the actual value of the correlator coming from the integral over very high momenta. But the fact that it's suppressed should be robust. But it's an interesting question how what exactly one should put here in ADS.
So if you naively try to sum to all orders, this is decoupling.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So if I just do it, g string goes to zero.
That's right. This is just g string goes to zero. So yeah, I'll talk about
the naive summation and a variety of other arguments. So unpublished would say that it goes like e to the minus omega. Which is enough anyway.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Although it's enough. It leads to some very different analytic behavior for the correlator.
Well, actually, before the world sheet gets as big as the space, at least if the space is big, you're going to get into the black hole regime, basically.
Not infinitesimal string coupling.
Finite string coupling.
That's right. So it's also interesting to think about finite string coupling, and that's let's also discuss that. And so we can imagine, for example, so there are these two different things going on. There's the effect of the string, and there's the effect of strong coupling effects in G string. To distinguish these two effects, let's imagine now that we're in a theory without low energy strings. So let's say in M theory, by which I mean the first new states that aren't supergravity states are of order the Planck scale. So that's what I mean by M theory. So in this case, it's harder to say what happens, but it's certainly true that the effective theory that we use to do our calculation breaks when delta t is of order L Planck. So we certainly can't trust this answer when we plug in delta t less than L Planck, but we can probably trust it when delta t is some small fraction of L Planck, 1/1000 L Planck, or something like that. Just the fact that we can trust it up to that scale actually gives something kind of interesting. So if we plug in L Planck to this formula, then we actually find that. So this is the first correction to the four-point function in one of our perturbation theory. If you plug in L Planck, you actually get something that that grows with n. Which means that at large n, it's actually giant compared to the tree level piece, the disconnected correlator.
Oh, this is just the four graviton interaction, or what? Yeah, which
delta t goes like what?
Which diagram is this?
So delta t is going like one over n squared. Yes. In this example, yeah.
So which diagram is this?
Which diagram? So I didn't specify exactly which which operators I'm talking about, but for example, you could take stress sensors, four-point function.
So it's just the four gravity.
Okay.
Yeah, but this one's the only one we don't have amplifier.
Okay.
So just.
Okay. I'm loud. Good. So if we trust the effective field theory up to the regime that we should be able to, we get this funny fact that the answer is actually bigger than the.
It just tells you you can't trust them.
Well, actually, I'll do a calculation in a second that shows that that basically organizes the calculation better and shows that this actually is the answer.
With 1/n²
corrections. That's right. Okay, so good. So let me just draw a summary.
So this seems to show that the consistency we're aiming for as a board is what we're doing.
That's right. So that's right. So the claim from this, as I'm about to draw, is that there is actually no singularity there. So there's no contradiction with, you might conjecture that all singularities are classified by Landau diagrams in the boundary, and there's no contradiction with that suggestion. At least that's what we expect if we look at the bulk physics more carefully. So let me just draw a graph to summarize.
But it's kind of a proof in the language. You couldn't have a bulk theory.
Exactly.
Except for higher speed theory.
Well, a higher spin theory is not a local field. So this is basically saying that the bulk is in some sense not really there. Not if you look closely enough with a small enough microscope, it's not really there. That's what we expect. Well, that's
not
true.
It's not there or it's not local.
It's not local. It's yeah. it's not local.
But it should be almost there, and almost local.
That's right. It should be. It should be almost there and almost local. So the tree level prediction is that there's a singularity. If we were in a string theory, this will be cut off at some scale of order L string due to this suppression. And in something like M theory, well, we don't necessarily know what's happening, but probably maybe it gets softened and removes the singularity. And this behavior is the thing that I'll address at the end of the talk, and we'll prove that this is actually the case in 2D CFTs.
So you prove that there's no singularity?
That's correct.
But didn't you know that for field physics?
Well,
there's no singularity aside from the room that you go on.
Well, I don't know how much we knew about this. I mean,
don't we know that field theory is in that region where you can't have sort of causal singularities that can't be singularity? Isn't that what goes into proofs of the screen direction?
You mean that all the singularities really lie on the light cone?
Well,
the local field
theory. That's what we expect. It's true. I mean, that's you can show this in perturbation.
Dispersion relation. Yeah, there's axiomatic field theory presence. Yeah, there's kind of causality.
Well, the singularity of this location is not ruled out by causality because the degrees of freedom have time. Well, that's the thing. So there's no Landau diagram on the boundary, but the degrees of freedom definitely would have time potentially to rearrange them.
There's no singularities in that region, and there's no discontinuity. Right? The amplitudes are real. Singularity, right?
Yeah.
Diagrams, they also, beyond just the location, they also tell you something that we know something about the discontinuity.
That's true, yeah. Okay, well, it sounds like you're saying that the thing that I will prove at the end of the talk is not surprising, and I'm sympathetic to that point of view, but I'm not sure that it's been proven. But maybe it has. Okay. Okay, good. Let's talk about it more. Okay.
Are you going to verify that power law too?
No. So the power law is extremely interesting, and unfortunately I won't verify the power. So what I'll show is an upper bound, and the upper bound will be a rough upper bound. So it will be bigger than any power, at least something exponential in n, and you might certainly hope to do better than see the power law. So even though the bulk isn't local, this is certainly an extremely striking feature to look for in the CFT correlator. Okay, so let's look at this from the CFT point of view and see what we can say. Um, So in general, the reason that the behavior of singularities in Lorentzian signature is less well understood is because to get to Lorentzian signature, you have to analytically continue from Euclidean signature, where we understand things better. In Euclidean signature, you can do computations using the OPE, and you can understand the behavior of correlators very well. But if you try to analytically continue to Lorentzian signature, then the analytic continuation may or may not commute with the OPE expansion. And the trick to try to learn things is to pick an analytic continuation and pick an OPE expansion such that along the continuation, the expansion remains convergent. And then you could actually use the expansion to do a computation. So the first thing I want to show is that the so this bulk point singularity is on the boundary of some of an OPE convergence region. And this will be the zeroth order thing we need to try to say something about it. The argument is very simple. Let me just draw the diagram we had again. So we have our two operators, O of x1, O of x2. And we're going to do an OPE expansion in this OPE, O of x1 with O of x2. This is equivalent to expanding in states propagating in this direction on the cylinder. O of x1 and O of x2 acting on the conformal vacuum create a state that I'll call psi. And in the future, we have O of x3, O of x4. And this is just the ket version of the same state with a rotation applied. So the four-point function is an overlap of psi, e to the I r times phi, where r is the generator of rotations, minus I t. So t is pi plus delta t times h, where h is the Hamiltonian, and then psi. So this, if you like, you can insert a complete set of states in the middle here, and you're weighting them according to their angular momentum and their energy. And the way to make the sum over states well behaved is to give delta t a small imaginary part. And if we do, then we have e to the minus epsilon h inserted in the four-point function. And this is enough to make it well behaved. And a nice tool for proving that it's well behaved is the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. So we can once we make this modification, we can write the four-point function as psi e to the minus epsilon over 2 h u e to the minus epsilon over 2 h psi, where u is a unitary operator, just e to the I r phi minus I pi h. And this is a dot product of states, u and v. And the dot product is less than the product of the norms. The norms of these states are the same. So this is less than or equal to psi e to the minus epsilon h psi. And this is just a four-point function on the Euclidean cylinder. Okay, so the picture would look exactly the same, except now the time direction is a Euclidean direction, and there's no rotation anymore. So in radial quantization, what this looks like is we have our two operators, 3 and 4, on the unit circle, and then two other operators on a somewhat smaller circle, and the distance between these guys is epsilon. Or 1 minus e to the minus epsilon. And this is perfectly finite because the points aren't on top of each other, and it's in Euclidean space, so we're confident we know what's going on. And in fact, we can estimate this using the OPE around these guys. So this is just approximately 1 over epsilon to the 4 delta. So as long as epsilon is non-zero, this sum over states is perfectly well-behaved. And the trick for getting to the bulk point region is to start in this Euclidean configuration with non-zero epsilon, and then analytically continue in the time direction to move on to the Lorentzian cylinder to implement this this evolution by pi, but all the while keeping epsilon non-zero. And then finally, we can take epsilon to zero to get to the region we're interested in. And the region we're this estimate goes to infinity as epsilon goes to zero. So it's not good enough to tell us that the correlator is finite. But at least we can get some handle by looking at it in this limit. That's right. So this isn't this is a baby step. But from this point of view, this is good enough to revisit the Witten diagram computation that I did at the beginning of the talk, and we'll understand it in a slightly different language, which will be instructive. So this is a computation done by Heemskerk, Polchinski, Panadones, and Sully. And they understood that this singularity that we're interested in can be thought of as coming from a sum over double trace operators. So double trace operators are where we take O and we sandwich a bunch of derivatives in between. And these have dimensions which are equal to 2 delta plus 2n plus L plus some anomalous dimension. And I'll put a 1 here to indicate that it's first order in 1 over n squared. And then there are higher order corrections in 1 over n squared. And they have OP coefficients that have some zeroth order piece plus some first order in 1 over n squared piece and so on. So the four-point function, we're interested in the four-point function in the bulk point region. And to write this formula, actually, let me introduce some coordinates. So as I said before, the strategy for getting to the bulk point region is going to be to start in Euclidean space and in this configuration and then analytically continue. So I'll introduce a useful coordinate for that, which is where we take two of the operators to be on the unit circle, and the other two operators diametrically opposite each other on a circle of radius r with some angle phi. Okay, so r and phi are useful coordinates. You can think of them as conformal cross ratios. They're just a substitute for the two usual conformal cross ratios. And sometimes useful to write rho is r e to the I phi. Rho bar is r e to the minus I phi. And in Euclidean space, rho and rho bar are complex conjugates. But in Lorentzian signature, to get to the Lorentzian cylinder, we start analytically continuing R so that rho and rho bar are no longer complex conjugates. And the region that we're interested in, the bulk point region, is R is e to the minus I pi. And we're going to stick in a little minus epsilon here, remember from this argument, just to make things convergent, to make sure everything remains convergent. So we're interested in the four-point function at R is e to the minus I pi minus epsilon and some phi. And this is a conformal block expansion that includes double trace operators. So it looks like this. These are the double trace operators, and then there are other operators that I'm going to ignore for a moment. The effect of the evolution by pi in the conformal blocks is to just add a phase. So the conformal blocks sum up operators in an individual conformal multiplet. The operators in an individual conformal multiplet have dimension equal to some delta plus integers. So the integers don't care so much about these minus I pi factors, which is why the conformal block has a nice monodromy property. So this is just equal to e to the minus I pi delta NL times the conformal block without the phase, which is just a Euclidean conformal block. And so now if we're going to look at the effect of these operators, many of the effects of these operators in this expansion are present in Euclidean space. So the anomalous dimension here appears here. So if we do 1/n expansion, we get derivatives of the conformal blocks with respect to dimension. And we also get corrections to the three-point coefficients. But both of those effects are present in the Euclidean computation. The only thing that's new that's not present in the Euclidean computation is this factor. So let's focus on the effects of that exponential factor. OK, so we have e to the minus I pi delta NL. This is e to the minus 2 pi I delta times e to the minus I pi gamma NL plus dot dot dot. And the computation that leads to a singularity, that leads to the singularity we saw in the Witt diagram before, is to expand this exponential and write it as 1 minus I pi gamma NL plus dot dot dot. And then these gammas have a behavior that looks like n to some power. So the four-point function has a sum over n and l. This becomes approximately, let me ignore l, it's not very important for this. So there's some sum over n. This becomes, in the limit we're interested in, an integral over n, which, if you do this carefully, is exactly the integral over omega that I wrote earlier. So basically n, which labels the sort of the center of mass energy of these double trace operators, becomes precisely the energy of the scattering process in the Witten diagram. Was there a comment? Question? Okay. Good. And the singularity in the Witten diagram comes from the fact that these anomalous dimensions go like some power in n. So the anomalous dimensions are just basically like the scattering amplitude. They basically are the scattering amplitude at leading order in 1/n². And the fact that they grow with energy is the thing that gives rise to this singularity. But this computation makes clear what we did wrong, which is that when this thing grows, we shouldn't have expanded the exponential. That was a bad idea. So when the anomalous dimension is big, we should put it back in here where we recognize that this is just a phase. The phases, well, If we just assume they're completely generic, then they're going to start to cancel out. And this suggests that the singularity should be softened if we're more careful. And this is a more precise version of this intuition that if you take into account, if you were to resum 1/n perturbation theory, then you would find that the singularity goes away. And this makes sense if you assume that the spectrum of the theory is sufficiently chaotic. There can be exceptions to this if there are coincidences in the spectrum. So the fact that we got a near singularity at all came from the fact that these dimensions had near coincidences in them. So there were many operators with dimensions that differed almost by integers, so that their contributions were summing up in phase. And you could imagine there might be other coincidences in the spectrum that would cause contributions to sum up in phase, and maybe it would violate this intuition. And an example of a case where that might happen, although we'll see that it doesn't, is in two dimensions, where there are many more coincidences in the operator spectrum coming from the Virasoro algebra. And so we should look at that case, and we should be more careful and see what happens. So let's see, when did I? OK, how am I doing on time?
Another about 20 minutes.
Oh, OK, great, fantastic. So
in contrast to earlier, are you saying that you can imagine designing the CFT where there are enough exact coincidences that you get an exact singularity, or just
Well, that's sort of the question.
It's not easy to design a CRP.
That's right. Yeah, I wouldn't know how to go about doing that. Okay. But yeah, so, but that's a good question.
Well, still, you don't want an exact singularity, right? Well, you'd like to see a growth, but not
you'd like to see a growth. So the large n factorization is, as we see from this computation, good enough to get you a growth. And actually, so let me address this computation. I said this claim before that the Witten diagram gives a bigger answer than the tree level case. So here we can look at the regime of validity of this computation, and it's valid if gamma NL is much less than 1. That's the condition for the computation to be good. And this turns out to be exactly the condition that delta T is less than L Planck. So the relation between delta T and N comes from the fact that the N integral has a saddle point that depends on delta T. So you can relate N and delta T. N is basically 1 over delta T. And these are the same conditions. So this justifies the claim that the correlator gets big, because this expression this almost justifies it. So this is a non-perturbative expression. This is definitely good. The only loophole that I didn't address is, what about these other operators? And so then you have to ask, well, what other operators are present in the spectrum? In the string theory, there will be relatively low dimension single trace operators that will come in and modify the physics. And so now we can ask, in a theory like M theory, where we don't expect there to be new supergravity modes up to the Planck scale, then these other operators will be suppressed. Their conformal blocks will be suppressed by epsilon delta other, e to the minus epsilon delta other. Epsilon is like delta T here, so. So this is good enough to show that they don't contribute to this computation if you're in something like M theory. So that justifies the claim that the correlator actually gets big. So this also makes clear a statement, one possible statement of what you might look for in a CFT to see bulk locality. So you would get an answer every time you put in a polynomial for gamma. You get a contribution to this bulk point locus that looks big. So if gamma looks kind of like a polynomial, then you get big contributions. So if gamma has some expansion in little n, that looks like this. If each higher order term in little n is suppressed by some scale, then this will guarantee that the correlator gets big until little n gets to be of order this size. And so this is the kind of thing that you would like to prove, starting from the n equals 4 Lagrangian, that the anomalous dimensions have this kind of pattern. And further, what should happen is this lambda should be equal to delta gap, the dimension of the lowest string state, which should be something like little lambda to the 1/4 thing.
You'd like to see this in an expansion around n equals 0, n over lambda equals 0?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, so analyticity in this little n.
I mean, I'm confused because you're using this for large n.
That's right. Good. Oh, thank you. So there's a capital N squared out front of this whole expression. So now I'm interested in the anomalous dimension at leading order in the nonplanar expansion. And I'm interested in its structure as a function of little n. I need to take little n bigger than 1. So little n bigger than 1, this should be for little n bigger than 1 and much less than capital lambda. So little n bigger than 1 is the condition that you probably need to have something sort of smooth and analytic in little n. And then I'm doing an expansion in little n over lambda.
All the cases we know agree with.
So what cases do you mean? Good. Fixed twist, you mean, or almost fixed twist. That's right. So that's right. So this would be a statement about the operators that are relevant for fixed angle scattering in the bulk, which is a different limit. So the fixed twist operators are relevant for sort of misses in the bulk. And so this is a different process, but you'd like to prove a similar theorem about these anomalous dimensions. And there was actually the bound on chaos due to Shanker, Stanford, and Maldacena implies a statement like this about the operators that are relevant in the Reggie limit of the theory. So what you kind of want is a similar bound on chaos that is relevant for the fixed angle case. So that would be something that would be very nice to prove, and it would essentially prove that the correlator in n equals 4 is big at this locus. And I should say also, this is a statement about the first nonplanar correction. It's something that could be addressed by integrability techniques, which are rapidly making progress in solving the planar theory. So if they could compute these anomalous dimensions, then that would be a way to see the emergence of bulk locality. So let me now go to the end of the talk, which is about non-perturbative singularities in 2D. So to get to the bulk point locus, we started in Euclidean signature, and we analytically continued, and we had control over what we were doing because we could use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality and prove that the OPE remained convergent when we did this. And so before showing what works in two dimensions to get a more powerful result, let me say what doesn't work. So we used this rho coordinate, and I should say, by the way, this rho coordinate, these r and phi, are due to Richkov and Hogervorst. That's their radial coordinate for conformal blocks. If we had, what Cauchy-Schwarz let us do is it let us look at the correlator for a different rho and rho bar, and bound it by the same correlator where we remove the phases in rho and rho bar. So we could take rho and rho bar which may not be complex conjugates in Lorentzian signature, but using Cauchy-Schwarz we can rotate them to the real axis and get a Euclidean correlator. And we actually need to, if we rotate them to different points in the real axis, we can use the fact that the correlator only shrinks when we move stuff towards the origin on the real axis. So we can additionally go that way. Anyway, the idea is you can remove phases with Cauchy-Schwarz. So if we had looked at this four-point function in the usual coordinates, where we use that for looking at CFT correlators, z and z bar, then what would have happened? Well, so the bulk point locus in the z and z bar coordinates actually lives here on the cut between 1 and infinity. The way to get to it is by you take z and you move it around the origin once, but not z bar, and then you move them both to this cut. So Cauchy-Schwarz is not helpful in this configuration because the radius of convergence of the OPE naively in this conformal frame is just the unit circle. So there's no way to use Cauchy-Schwarz to remove phases to get here. So it's very useful to use this conformal frame. And so that leads to the question, in 2D, maybe there's an even better conformal frame, because in 2D we have a lot more freedom to choose conformal frames. So maybe there's some ultimate conformal frame that gives some ultimate coordinate, the best coordinate for looking at 2D four-point functions. So now I'll show what that is. So here's our four-point function. We have operators at 0, 1, z and infinity. And I'm just drawing it as a P1, as a two-sphere. It turns out that the best conformal frame is to go to a metric that's flat everywhere except for conical defects at the operators. Sorry, let me label this a little better. So, okay. So you flatten it out, except for conical defects. And what I mean by this is, this geometry is sometimes called a pillowcase. And it's what you would get if you took two sheets of paper, stuck them on top of each other, and glued them around their edges. Yes. Yes, it is. That's exactly right. Right. Yeah. I think this probably appears in a few different cases. But yes. So the way to get the conformal transformation is to notice that this pillowcase geometry is T2 mod Z2, one can write down the torus in the plane. In the plane, the torus that's related to this configuration is where you have cuts between 0, z, 1, and infinity. This is y squared equals x times x minus z times 1 minus x. That's the equation for an elliptic curve. And if you take the uniform coordinate on this elliptic curve, it becomes the flat coordinate on this T2 mod Z2. And the reason for the mod Z2 is because, so the elliptic curve is a double cover of the plane with branches. But we want the plane. We don't want the torus. So the way to get back to the plane is to smash that double cover together, to mod out by the Z2 that swaps the two branches. So that's why we get T2 mod Z2. So the geometry of this torus is as follows. We can normalize this length to be pi. So if this length is pi, then that means that this circle that goes around this way has length 2 pi. And by the way, the edges are not special because there's no curvature at the edges. So there's a length 2 pi circle around here that we can call A. That's this circle. And if this distance is pi, then this distance is minus I pi tau, where tau, as David anticipated, is related to elliptic functions. And the idea is to quantize the four-point function in this geometry. So when we do that, we get an expression for the four-point function as an overlap between states. So we can look at this little piece of path integral at the bottom here and call this a state, psi prime. We have the same state at the top. Here, the bra state as opposed to the ket state. And the effect of this bit of path integral in the middle is to evolve by a time minus I pi tau. So what you get is the four-point function is equal to psi prime time evolution. So let me define q is e to the I pi tau. So you get a time evolution with the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is L naught minus C over 24. There's a Q bar to the L naught bar minus C over 24 psi prime. And this is equal to our four-point function that we're interested in. Almost. The almost is because there's a factor coming from the vial rescaling going between these two metrics. Those are some additional factor, lambda of z squared, where lambda of z just comes essentially from the vial anomaly and from treating these conical defects carefully. So the claim is that the four-point function can be written in this way. This might look vaguely familiar to some of you. The variable q shows up in an expression, a recursion relation due to Zamolodchikov for Virasoro conformal blocks. So one of the things he noticed is that the Virasoro conformal blocks have a nice q expansion. And there's a prefactor in his recursion relation which has some mysterious theta functions in it. This is precisely this mysterious prefactor in his expression. So the claim is that Zamolodchikov was actually finding that the Virasoro blocks look nice if you do their expansion in this conformal frame. So you could call those his expression the pillowcase Virasoro blocks. And those are the nice things to look at. Having an expansion in Q is very useful because now we can use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality with Q. And basically what we've done here is by moving to this conformal frame and then re-expanding in states, this is a way of, we get another expression for the four-point function. We're basically reorganizing the Virasoro multiplet in different ways. And the claim is that this is a very useful reorganization of the Virasoro multiplets that lets us get a good handle on the analytic continuation. And the reason is that, so before we had rho, and we were happy if we stayed inside the unit rho circle, and q maps the entire unit rho circle to a small region inside the unit q circle. So the correlator that the correlators on the Lorentzian cylinder corresponded to moving around the boundary of the unit rho circle. As we move in time, we move around in this coordinate. But in this picture, we just do this. We move along the boundary of this thing. And most of the points are completely well-behaved regular analytic points of the correlator. For example, if we sit here, so this corresponds to some amount of time evolution on the Lorentzian cylinder, then we can use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality to rotate away the phase down to this point. And there it's a perfectly regular Euclidean four-point function. So this means you can use Cauchy-Schwarz together with this expression to get a bound on the four-point function, even on the Lorentzian cylinder. I'll write an example of such a bound. So we might be interested in the four-point function in the bulk point region. So that's r equals e to the minus I pi. Now we don't need a minus epsilon anymore because we're well within the regime of convergence of the OPE. And just for illustrative purposes, let me take some angle pi over 2. So you can show that this is less than or equal to 2 to the c over 8 minus 4 delta times the Euclidean four-point function. At z equals z bar equals 12 root 2 minus 16, which is about 0.97. And this is perfectly finite. So this is a bound on the size of the correlator in the bulk point region in any 2D CFT. It's consistent with the earlier claim that the correlator can grow with n. Because so c is n squared, let's say, and this is some exponential in c, and so it's bigger than any power of n, and before we were getting powers of n. So this is that rough bound that I referred to earlier in the talk. It would be nice to make more assumptions about the CFT, assume that it looks more like what we expect holographic theory to be, and maybe get a stronger bound that maybe even has powers of c instead of exponentials. Although I think that would be It would have to be a pretty detailed argument, because the power of C is coming from this, from the Weyl transformation between these two metrics, and it would have to be something that somehow cancels off the Weyl anomaly piece as a new piece. But anyway, it would be interesting to think about. Before I end, I just want to justify this claim that Q is the ultimate variable for thinking about 2D four-point functions. So the most general thing you might want to do, besides looking at a bulk point correlator, is you might want to look at some arbitrary, crazy analytic continuation of the four-point function. So we take Z, and we move it around. We go around all the singularities in some crazy way, whatever we want, and then look what happens. This can compute interesting observables. So different analytic continuations can compute different orderings, different time orderings of four-point functions and different geometries. So there are lots of interesting things to look at. So in general, the four-point function is defined on the universal cover of the three-punctured sphere. Actually, two copies of the universal cover of the three-punctured sphere, because we can move Z and Z bar around independently. And Q has this nice property that it maps the entire universal cover of the three-punctured sphere inside the unit Q disk. So that means that there's just a single OPE is enough, a single OPE converges everywhere after any analytic continuation of the four-point function. The only special points are when Z approaches 0, 1, or infinity on some sheet after some analytic continuation, and those map to points on the boundary of the unit Q disk. So for example, we had two of those points here that you could get to by evolving in the Lorentzian cylinder. So the correlator can be infinite here if Q is plus 1 or if Q is minus 1. And those are exactly the light cone singularities. So that's good. You can still have light cone singularities. So this shows that the only singularities of a four-point function in a 2D CFT after any analytic continuation can only be light cone singularities. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
So this proof really uses.
We're basically using the Virasoro algebra.
We don't have anything in 3 or higher.
That's right, yeah.
And second of all, you keep saying, although it seems to be wiped out locality completely, or this argument plus all the other elements. So you don't ever have anything local. You're saying that there's some signs that you have something that looks like it's kind of local.
That's right, yeah.
You should have local, from the ADL scale down to the Strong scale.
Yeah, sure. Locality is well-defined concept. Non-locality
is,
so it's not local.
But there's growth in the amplitudes that is, you would expect, that is characteristic of a local theory. You're seeing yourself headed towards the singularity until it's cut off.
Some of my friends like Steve would like to argue that that's evidence of locality. Well, or people like Steve Schenker try to argue that there's evidence by analytic configuration for singularity. Seems to me this is more along the line that there is no non-locality. There might be growth or being or so on.
Right.
Locality isn't.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's almost, there are parameters that you can tune that make it closer and closer to looking local.
Yeah, but I can tune a coupling as well. I mean, not necessarily correlate local. It just means that you're doing something with one way of looking at it, which would give, if it were local, if there was a local form of a singularity, that way breaks down. But it doesn't mean locality.
Well, it's
not
a test.
The kind you were looking for.
Well, it's a test of whether you have something that approximately looks like locality down to some scale like the string scale.
But it's
well. In the end, we don't expect to have it at the string scale, but I think everyone expects to have it at much longer distance scale.
It is.
This kind of
behavior
of amplitude.
I would
this characteristic of local quantum.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
There are regimes that are packed with local quantum filters for the best. not where you're looking at the lookout.
That's right. And I think the claim is maybe not surprising that there shouldn't be a regime in which local quantum field theory is exact. That's not a surprise.
But this strengthens the argument that anything that's dual to a local quantum field theory on CFP is not a local quantum field theory.
Right. So this is...
And it's probably a string theory, M theory. But
sure, exactly.
It tells us something about whatever the thing in three dimensions is.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you could define the size. You could think of the size of the four-point function at this locus as a measure of how almost locally you are, and this
Unless
is.
Unless I have points, it's hard for me to even define what kind of mean.
Well, let me define it that way. I mean, so I'm not defining locality. I'm defining how almost local something is. Let's say we don't. I can make that definition. And then, for example, this shows that you could never achieve some. There's a limit on how almost local it can be in, say, a theory with small central charge. So to get the bulk to emerge, you need higher central charge, which is something, of course, we all expect. And the game here is just to see how much one can prove with axiomatic CFT techniques.
I think what we are looking for, for those who believe in duality, is something that does look local to a very good approximation. It scales longest compared to the string scale in bulk. Right? So that's a test of ABS-CFT. I think you can basically make that kind of test sharp with these kinds of considerations. And it's a non-trivial test because there's this whole question of whether you can get out the kind of growth that is needed for approximate locality or not from boundary CFT.
Other questions? Okay. Let's thank David again.